dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the long-running battlefronts in that war, of course, is the nation of Afghanistan. Since shortly after 9/11, U.S. forces, initially unconventional forces and subsequently big army, the conventional forces of the United States, have been in that country to varying degrees engaged in combat operations against primarily the Taliban, a jihadist organization backed by Pakistan that has in the past misruled the country and that is determined to do so once again. President Trump unburdened himself yesterday in some offhand remarks on the margins of his meeting with the Romanian president about his frustrations with Afghanistan, his clear desire to end America's longest war, and his belief that there are other things that we could be doing there, other options, perhaps a much reduced presence, but that among them is the idea of negotiating with the Taliban. To discuss these various ideas and their implications, we're going to spend this full hour talking to two men who have given a lot of thought to the problems we're facing today and who are informed by some hard experience in the past as they consider the options before the President of the United States. Our first guest is Eric Prince. We are very grateful to him for taking a few minutes to sort of set the stage for a longer conversation with Steve Young of the Co-Roundtable in our second through fourth segments. Eric Prince, it's very good to have you with us. Thank you so much for taking a very few minutes to tell us about the challenge that we're facing in Afghanistan at the moment and one of the options that President Trump ought to be seriously considering.
Thanks, Frank. The president's instincts are right to end this endless war. But I think, I know the United States cannot just leave Afghanistan because it will become yet again the primary tumor site of all kinds of cancer metastasis, of terrorism all over the world. So you have to leave some capability in place to keep the Afghan security forces upright. Right now you have 15,000 U.S. troops and 37,000 contractors supporting the U.S. presence there, which is an unsustainable, very expensive number. We're spending more than the entire U.K. defense budget just in Afghanistan. If the president is really looking at options, if his staff is doing their job, they should look at my unconventional operation or my unconventional solution, which is really, you know, everyone loves to praise veterans, but they like to dump on contractors. The fact is we would use veterans as contractors to go back in and attach and live long-term with the Afghan units that they're to support. They go back to the same unit in the same valley year over year over year in a different deployment method than the U.S. has used. You know, because the U.S. has been sending conventional forces there. They're in country for 6 to 8 months, and then they come home, and they have no continuity, and we've done that rotation more than 30 times now. So, again, veterans assigned to each Afghan unit, they would go as volunteers. They paid very well to take that risk and to have that dislocation for their life. You have to have reliable air power because, dozens of times a week, Afghan units are surrounded and annihilated. They're overwhelmed because nobody ever shows up with resupply, with medevac, with close air support, et cetera. And the way the U.S. has been doing it, trying to educate a 90% illiterate population to build an air force, is at this point a bridge too far. So fine, use a model of rented, contracted capability with an Afghan pilot in the aircraft and also with a professional pilot in the aircraft, exactly the way the U.S. did with the Flying Tigers when we were helping defend China from Japanese aggression in the beginning months of World War II. So If you do those two things, you provide some, I would say, governance support to the Afghan security forces to make sure the food, the fuel, the payroll, the supplies are done in a professional way with a handful of people, we can actually keep the lights on in Afghanistan. We can keep the Afghan security forces from collapsing and prevent the country from being overrun and becoming another major exporter of terrorism. All that costs less than 10% of what the U.S. is spending now. So the president could truly take all or most of the U.S. combat forces home. You'd leave a couple thousand special forces in country to manage the process and to keep a unilateral direct action capability. But the rest of them, you could take your number of 37,000 contractors down to 6,000. If the president, if his staff is doing their job, they should look at the options. The fact is, they don't like to look at a contracted option, but there's all kinds of historical precedent to it. It would save the taxpayers a lot of money. And most importantly, we would stop wasting our blood and treasure, particularly the blood of our 18 to 25-year-old kids who go there as enlisted people who have never been overseas before, and they're going to fight in a war that their fathers already have fought in. It's time to stop a multi-generational war in America.
That's different, though, than surrendering to the enemy, and it's Absolutely. An alternative that has a prospect of success contingent upon a couple of things, Eric. You've laid out, and it makes eminent sense to me, that we would adapt past practice in this present circumstance. We would reduce the footprint both of American uniformed personnel and contractor support, and we would take the war to the Taliban. Presumably, there has to be an Afghan government. There has to be an Afghan military with whom we would work. And I guess the thing that troubles me most about what we're watching here with the president and this present negotiating approach is we're leaving them completely out of that conversation, which is almost certainly being read by our enemies as evidence that we are prepared to do to them what the United States previously did in Vietnam.
That's right, Frank. The problem is the staff around the president is so blockheaded and not opening their minds to what other options are, the president is being forced to result to his instinct to say, hey, listen, if you're not going to give me an option other than more money and more troops, we're pulling out. Because if we're not fighting for real and we're not fighting to finish it, then he's done. And that's the instinct he ran on. And I kind of agree with that. Stop wasting blood and treasure.
Eric Prince, I know we have to let you go. Thank you very much for your time today, for your past service to our country in uniform and at Blackwater. And that I very much hope you will be rendering in Afghanistan, if President Trump actually has an opportunity to take aboard your impressive and, I think, very promising alternative approach to, well, surrendering the place to the Taliban. God bless you, sir. Come back to us again very soon. Next up, Stephen Young of the Co Roundtable, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I am very pleased to say we are now going to broaden the lens from the first block of this show talking about Afghanistan and what we should be doing there. From the focus that Eric Prince gave us, looking specifically at the military component, to a broader approach informed by hard experience, specifically experience in Vietnam. Our guest for that purpose is Stephen Young. He is a Harvard-trained lawyer. He is a man who served our country in Vietnam as a first field
operative of, and then as the, one of the managers of something called the CORDS program. It stands for Civil Operations and Rural Development Support. It was a program that was quite successful in its time, but came a cropper through no fault of Stephen Young and his counterparts. We're going to talk through that experience because I believe that it has a lot to tell us about how we should proceed at this point with respect to Afghanistan. Stephen Young, thank you very much for joining us. As well as all of that, you these days run the Co-Roundtable on Moral Capitalism, which is a subject to which I hope we can turn to in another time with you. But for the moment, you've not heard what Eric Prince said in our previous segment, but the short format of it is he believes that we mustn't surrender Afghanistan to the Taliban and that there are more effective ways to fight them. I'm interested in talking with you about some of the elements that must be brought to bear for that really to succeed. And I'd like to start by asking you about how things worked out with respect to the Civil Operations and Rural Development Support Initiative, of which you were an important part in Vietnam, when we were contending with another adversary determined to defeat us and expel us so that they would, in the end, be in complete control of that country. Welcome back, sir.
Thanks. Thank you, Frank. Well, first, I'd just like to say that I completely agree with Eric Prince that surrender and defeat are unacceptable. I think if we look back at what's going on in our country today, the angst, the anxiety, the anger, the polarization, the sense of failure, we can trace it back to our giving up and surrendering in Vietnam. That, I think, tarnished our sense of who we were as Americans. It gave the left wing in our country a kind of a moral boost, because they had made the argument that our war in Vietnam was immoral and unjust and couldn't do it, and reflected the, you know, American hubris and capitalism and all those things, all of which was bullshit. But if they won the war, I mean, because they, you know, the old cry was, you probably remember that, Ho Chi Minh, NLF is going to win. So their side, in effect, won the war. And then, oh, by the way, after 75, nobody said anything from the left about Cambodia and Pol Pot as their guys, the communists. You know, we got out, and what happened? The winners, the communists, killed, what, 1.5 million, 2 million of their own people?
And that's just Cambodia. Vietnam was also a bloodbath.
Yep. So the prospects in Afghanistan, if we just surrender and pull out, would, for us as Americans, would be another blow to our sense that we are really a good people.
Well, to say nothing of emboldening our enemies there in Afghanistan and worldwide to redouble their efforts to kill us, something that was not as much of a problem in the Vietnam case. But talk to us about the CORDS program, if you would, quickly.
Right. Very quickly. So the CORDS program was really the foundation and the part of what was called Vietnamization, which some of your older listeners may remember, others may not. The Vietnamization program was actually conceived by Lyndon Johnson in late 1966, but the name and the implementation are associated with President Richard Nixon. It was basically withdrawing American troops without losing the war. And that's a tough concept for some people to get a hold of. How do you do that? Well, the way you do that is you turn over the responsibility for defense to the local people. And you pull the American troops out, and that means that the South Vietnamese troops, they had to step up to fight the invading NVA battalions. But as they stepped up to do that, they would leave exposed the rural areas. So who's going to provide your defense for the rural areas, for all the rural people? Well, the answer was suggested by Vietnamese themselves and by a brilliant American, William Colby, in particular, that the local people themselves defend themselves. So the CORDS program was working with all the villages, 2,000-some villages across South Vietnam, to empower them with guns, with money, with local government, and that provided a firm foundation, and the American troops left, and it all worked. By the end of 1972, the North Vietnamese major army invasion had been defeated. The American troops had left, and the Viet Cong soldiers in Viet Cong units had been reduced to 25,000 effectives, 25,000 men, whereas the South Vietnamese had something like over 750,000 men under arms. So it was a very successful program.
And just point of clarification, when you say the Americans had left, they'd withdrawn from most of these rural areas.
They withdrew from the whole country,
Completely out of the country?
I think by the end of 72, we had something like, we still had air power. But I think by 1972, we had maybe 25,000 Americans left. I mean, a very small number, most of whom were in sort of logistics, about support functions and some combat units, but the bulk of American combat fighting power had left. In 1972, the North Vietnamese invasion was met on the ground only by South Vietnamese forces. And the South Vietnamese, they took some hard knocks, but they basically, with help from the B-52s, they held the line. They defended their own country. However, in the Paris Peace Agreement, which had been secretly negotiated, the North Vietnamese got to keep their army inside South Vietnam.
Well, hold that thought. Steve Young, I want to just back up for a moment. While you were doing this Vietnamization effort, there were negotiations taking place secretively involving Henry Kissinger, initially the National Security Advisor to President Nixon, ultimately to become under Gerald Ford the Secretary of State. And these secret negotiations were not only secret from, you know, the press, they were secret from the government of South Vietnam. They were being kept secret in varying degrees from even our ambassador to South Vietnam, with whom you worked, Ellsworth Bunker. And they were certainly being kept secret from people like you trying to make this Vietnamization effort work. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. And on the military side, Frank, and this is confirmed in Lou Sorley's book on General Abrams, they were kept hidden from our senior military commander, who had to plan for the future defense of South Vietnam. And he was never told, as I understand it, until the last minute, that, oh, by the way, the North Vietnamese are going to keep Masomena's 300,000 regular troops, which I know it's multi-division equivalent.
In South Vietnam.
Inside South Vietnam.
And all U.S. forces were going to be removed, is that right?
Yeah, all American forces were going to go, including our air power. Now, the way it was worked out with Thieu is that the Americans asked Thieu, this is Kissinger's suggestion, that Kissinger, well, there were, people may remember, there were formal peace negotiations in Paris at a big sort of hotel and lots of arguments over the four parties, the North. And this is a parallel to Afghanistan, to the shape of the table. So you had the North Vietnamese communists, you had the Americans, you had the South Vietnamese nationalists, and you had the Viet Cong. So, and those sessions sort of were going nowhere. Kissinger wanted to see if he could get a negotiated settlement. He didn't believe in Vietnamization. He didn't believe in the South Vietnamese at all. So he suggested that he would have private discussions with the North Vietnamese to explore points. So this was presented to President Thieu to ask him his permission, and Thieu said, fine, probably helpful because it's a very Asian way of doing things. You save people's face. You have private discussions to kind of talk about, you know, how we might solve something or where we might agree. But Thieu said, no agreement can be made in those secret talks. So then Kissinger would have the secret talks, and then he would send basically short summaries of the talks to Ambassador Bunker in Saigon, who would then go meet with President Thieu and read the cable from Kissinger. So the only thing Thieu knew is what Kissinger wanted him to know. And on one particular point, leaving the North Vietnamese troops in South Vietnam, Kissinger didn't exactly tell the whole truth. So both Bunker and Thieu were left in the dark that Kissinger had made a major concession which put at risk not only the survival of South Vietnam, but the sacrifices of all Americans.
Now, you have been working with the memoirs of Ellsworth Bunker, as I understand it, Steve Young, yeah, posthumously. You've also, as I understand it, had a conversation with former President Nixon himself about what he knew of this arrangement. Tell us about all that.
Yes. So there was a separate exchange exchange of cables, secret cables, between Kissinger and Ambassador Bunker, which did not go through the normal State Department channels. So the text of those cables were not in the regular State Department files. They were kept in a different file, which I was told about when I was working with Ambassador Bunker, and I had a top secret clearance back then, and so I was able to read them. So what happened was, and I think April 1971, so this is in the middle of Vietnamization, Kissinger writes Bunker and says, we're going to have another secret meeting with the North Vietnamese. Could you come up with some ideas? So Bunker comes up with a proposal, with a plan for ending the war. Step number one was you go to the North Vietnamese and you say, guys, basically it's over. We're getting out. We're going to support the South Vietnamese. They're getting stronger. We're going to continue to give them economic aid. We're going to supply them militarily, and that's it. However, if you want to leave something for your southern supporters, we are willing to have another meeting and talk about that.
Hold that thought, if you would, Steve Young. We have to take a short break.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We are visiting with Stephen Young, a remarkable resource with great corporate memory about some hard experience the United States had in Vietnam, both success of the CORDS program, a Vietnamization effort that could be a model for what we need to do in Afghanistan at the moment. And you're just giving us the blow-by-blow on a critical moment as Henry Kissinger was essentially selling out the Nixon Vietnamization plan. Complete that thought, if you would, Steve Young.
And Bunker came up with his 7 points, which Kissinger in his memoirs praises. Oh, first of all, Kissinger in his memoirs takes all credit for it. He doesn't say Bunker authored this. He said, you know, it's my plan. That this was the shape of the final peace agreement. Bunker had in his draft the requirement that the North Vietnamese forces leave South Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. So he sends this off to Kissinger in April. And then on May 25, 1971, Kissinger sends a cable back to Bunker, and he says, I'm reading the text, Frank, in this cable, May 25, 1971, on your point six, this is where Bunker had said, the North Vietnamese have got to leave. They got to get out of South Vietnam.
So they could talk about ways that they might support their Viet Cong allies, but that was a separate conversation, and it was against the backdrop of them being absolutely out of the country.
Right. This is Kissinger's directions to Bunker. Quote, we will say to the North Vietnamese that peoples of Indochina should discuss this question among themselves, but we will not set date. So what Kissinger has just dropped is the American requirement that the North Vietnamese pull their troops out. And he indicates in his memoirs that once the North Vietnamese saw that, they got interested, because that gave them the theory of the decent interval.
Right. The decent interval being basically that they would win after a short period of time.
Right. Now, I discovered much later in the Gerald R. Ford Library another document dated the same day, May 25, 1971. And this is a meeting with a French guy named Jean Saint-Denis, meeting with Henry Kissinger, General Haig, Dick Smizer, and Win Lord in Dr. Kissinger's office. And Saint-Denis starts out the meeting. I'm just going to read this short paragraph, this sentence. Quote, Hanoi does not fully believe that the Americans will leave Vietnam. If they were assured of that and of a certain number of seats for the NLF, Viet Cong, in the assembly, they would come to terms on POW ceasefire and the separation of the two Vietnams for a number of years. So Hanoi proposes to Kissinger on that day the decent interval. You just get out of Vietnam, we'll let the South stand for a couple of years, and then we'll take it over. We'll save your face. And Kissinger that same day adopts this position and tells Bunker that he's no longer going to demand the withdrawal of the North Vietnamese troops.
Your reading of this history, just to put it in layman's language, Steve Young, is that the meeting with this fellow Saint-Denis, who was a spokesperson for or you know, representative of, effectively, the North Vietnamese, that Kissinger got the word as to how he could get a decent interval if he simply collapsed on this idea that there was going to be a precondition that the North Vietnamese military had to leave all of these, not just South Vietnam, but Cambodia and Laos altogether. And he then subsequently indicated to Ellsworth Bunker, our ambassador, that that would be the new plan, the fundamental revision or gutting, if you will, of what it was that Ellsworth Bunker had suggested be the basis for secret conversations with the North Vietnamese. Is that right?
Right. But then it gets more complicated, Frank, because Bunker doesn't quite understand the implications. Bunker, and I talked to him about this. This is going to get to how I got to see Nixon. Bunker, I asked Bunker about this. I said, "Mr. Ambassador," and he was an older man when I was working with him, and I suddenly realized that he had been blind. He never knew in 71 what Kissinger, that was the point when Kissinger took the fall, the implication, because President Nixon had given a big speech, I think in October 70 or something, saying that North Vietnam must remove its troops. And from, I think, Bunker's point of view, since the president had not instructed him that he was changing his position, Bunker assumed that Kissinger was still operating under the direction of President Nixon. And then in his book and a couple of other cables, Kissinger kind of very cleverly sort of, he doesn't actually say it, but he sort of insinuates it, that Nixon made all these decisions. Oh, in the cable back to Bunker, he said that the president has decided to jump from your proposed meeting number one, go directly to your meeting number two and talk terms. And I just had my suspicions that Kissinger had not told the entire truth. So I got to know President Nixon in the early 80s, asked an introduction from Bunker. Nixon, in our first meeting, he was very suspicious of me because I was a Harvard guy and this and that. And my dad, fortunately, had worked. I suddenly remembered to emphasize this. He'd worked for the Eisenhower-Nixon administration in the 1950s on Southeast Asia, was trusted by John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles. So I kind of, you know, use that as saying, you know, I'm really a friend. Yeah. And then I got to know Nixon. And then a couple of years, but I didn't want to spring this on him until I had a relationship. And a couple of years later, I'm now out in Minnesota, dean of a law school. I go back to see him at his new presidential office in New Jersey. And at one point I say, "Oh, Mr. President, could I ask you a question?" He said, "Sure, Steve, anything." I said, "Well, I want to go back to Vietnam." And his face begins to look a little puzzled. And I said, "Mr. President, do you have any memory of Henry, that's Kissinger, coming to you and presenting Bunker's recommendations for the negotiation, step number one, step number two?" And Nixon's looking very puzzled, and like he's trying to think and recall. He says, "No, Steve, I don't know. What was that all about?" And I said, "Well, Bunker came up with step one, step two, and in step number two, he insisted that all the North Vietnamese forces leave." And then Henry jumped immediately to step number two and deleted that. And Nixon's face began to turn ashen. And he said, "Well, Steve, so what difference would it have made?" So then I swallowed hard and said, "Mr. President, because of that decision by Kissinger, we lost the war." And he turned away from me, looked at the wall a long, long time. His body was very uncomfortable, body English. Then he slowly turned his face back towards me and changed the subject. So I interpret from that Kissinger had never gone to him. There's also a memorandum, and it is published now in the Foreign Relations Files, that Kissinger sent to Nixon on May 27, 1971, before he goes to talk to North Vietnamese.
But 2 days after these other correspondences you're talking about.
And he does not bring to the attention of his president that he will now cave on the North Vietnamese troops.
Yeah. Steve, there's so much here, and I don't want to cut it short, but the real reason for having you on today is to learn from this history. And I fear that in some respects, we may be seeing it being repeated as we speak with the somewhat secret negotiations. They're not completely unknown, but what exactly is going on and the nature of the deal that is being conjured by Zalmay Khalilzad, a man who's been on this program a number of times, who's now leading the negotiations with the Taliban in Doha, Qatar, at the moment, to what seems to be the end of getting all American forces out of the country. At least that's the Taliban demand. The president has indicated we're going to need to have some presence there, but it, again, remains to be seen whether that's what's going to be reflected in Zal's terms, should they be there be an agreement. But also that there seems to be a level of, well, shall we say, freelancing going on here. And I want you to sort of put in your own words the lessons that we need to take away from what Kissinger did and not replicate in this context, particularly in light of what a disaster it proved to be. Eric Prince said a moment ago, the image of helicopters lifting off of the roof of the U.S. Embassy in Vietnam in the wake of the North Vietnamese invasion and our complete rout and the destruction of our allies in South Vietnam.
Yeah, one thing is, I mean, Vietnam and under the communists, you know, Vietnam has an ocean coastline, right? So a whole lot of oppressed Vietnamese could get in boats and flee. So if in 2 years you're going to be put out and whatever the Taliban are going to do to you because you're not Muslim enough, what are you going to do? Run to Pakistan over the mountains?
Not a terribly appetizing prospect.
Yeah. Exact parallel between what Kissinger did and what's going on right now. First of all, the Americans, the great power, are negotiating with the enemy of their ally, right? Direct negotiations between the Americans and the enemy of their ally without accurate and full cooperation from your ally. They're not at the table with their enemy. We're doing a back channel thing with the enemy. Secondly, the parallel is we just want to save face. That's how I read President Trump's statements. You know, 19 years is enough. We can't win. Let's get the hell out of there. Just let me get my troops out, and then the devil take the hindmost, as if the sacrifices of American soldiers and wounded people and our money over 19 years, we can just blow it off as like, you know, a bad stick of chewing gum.
In fairness, Steve, I'm not sure that's what he's saying at the moment. That may be what Zalmay Khalilzad thinks is his direction, and if so, it's very, very alarming, needless to say. But, you know, I want to latch on to and hold on to some of the key pieces of what the president said in his remarks yesterday about retaining a presence in Afghanistan and not wanting it to become, a tribute to your alma mater, the Harvard University of Terrorism, or become more of that, I guess, and that he's open to options as to what to do. And so, Steve, we have to take another break. More with Steve Young, straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back for our final installment with Stephen Young of the Co-Roundtable on Moral Capitalism. He is the author of, among other important works, a book about China and Vietnam entitled The Tradition of Human Rights in China and Vietnam, born in part of his extensive experience in the region, including during the Vietnam War. Steve Young, we've talked about the lessons that we should take away from secret diplomacy conducted with our enemies to the exclusion of our allies. This seems to me, once again, if it's allowed to run its course, to likely result in the abject surrender and defeat of the United States in yet another country. And you said at the very beginning, we're still living with the consequences of that defeat in Vietnam. It would be, I believe, vastly worse in this case, because we would, in the process of losing Afghanistan, be greatly emboldening the jihad worldwide against us. So let's talk a little bit about what we should be doing Eric Prince has offered some suggestions about how to deal with the kinetic piece of this problem, posed now by not just the Taliban, by the way, but by the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda. You, I know, are a supporter of a similar kind of approach to that you usefully pursued in Vietnam, this CORDS program, as it's called, the Civil Operations and Rural Development Support. Talk about what you would do in that regard in Afghanistan, if you could, and how it might be, as I said earlier, sort of synthesized with the kinetic piece.
Well, what we could do very simply is we create a CORDS organization in the private sector, combining experienced military people with development people, a combined civil-military effort working very closely with the Afghan government to build up, to empower all the villages across Afghanistan. And that would defeat the Taliban. We could have done that 19 years ago, but people didn't want to recall Vietnam, I'm sorry to say. In Afghanistan today, there's something called CDCs, Community Development Councils, which were put together, I think, started by now President Ashraf Ghani when he was a minister. There were like 18,000 or 22,000 of these local councils in rural communities. The councils could be developed into, in effect, local governments with their own self-defense forces, their own development budgets, their own politics, and picking up on Eric Prince's idea, we could have trained Americans. We have a number of Americans. My nephew is one of them, by the way, an ex-Marine, who spent one or two tours in Afghanistan and speak either Pashto or Dari. I mean, and they care about the Afghans. And they could be hired, and they could go, and they could work with these villagers to train them in small arms and defense operations and offensive operations. And that would be a real check against the Taliban and prevent them from just militarily conquering the country again. I don't see any real problem with that. And it wouldn't cost all that much money either.
So you're saying, if I understand this correctly, Steve Young, that we have an infrastructure to build on that's already in place. What would it take to, you know, turn them into the real barrier to the Afghans, based on your experience in Vietnam? Is it getting them guns? Is it getting them training? Is it giving them help with the development side, including funding? We've had a lot of bad experience, I think it's fair to say, with pouring money down rat holes in Afghanistan. How would the approach that you used in Vietnam prove more accountable and more likely to translate into real value and capabilities in the Afghan setting?
Well, the first point, let me talk about a credit program I set up in Vietnam. And where do you put the decision making? Is it with the people, or is it with higher officials, military or civilian, who now you're suddenly giving them a development budget and they can take a cut of it? Or do you give the money directly to the people? In South Vietnam, I set up credit committees for every village in Vietnam, and it turned out to be incredibly simple. What it was a checkbook. So you get it, you get the village to open up an account with a local branch of the agricultural bank. The committee has a checkbook. This is all done in the open. All the villagers know what's going on. And you write a check to a lady who wants to buy two pigs, right? So she gets the check. She cashes it in. She buys the two pigs. She's going to have 10 little babies, and she'll sell the babies. She'll keep a couple. She'll pay back the money. In a village setting all around the world, everywhere I've been, other people are going to be looking over her shoulder, right? They're going to know that she's actually raising the pigs, and because if she repays the loan, guess what? The money is going to be available for somebody else, maybe me, in the next lending cycle. So the big failure, I think, in Afghanistan, it's typical from the foreign outside power, is you think you put all your resources at the central government level, which then operates down at a provincial level, and then there's a district level, and then underneath the district are the people.
And the trickle-down approach, is there's not much that gets down to the local level.
Not much gets down to local level. So trust the people. This was Colby's instinct and genius in Vietnam. Figure out local mechanisms where the people have checks and balances against each other. And then you give them land, you give them guns, you give them political power, you give them a policeman, and you give them development money, and you let them, if they want a school, they build a schoolhouse. I remember when I showed up at a little village in Vinlong the first time, the district chief took me out proudly to show the new American advisor, you know, this three-room schoolhouse that he built in some village. And I'm looking, it's a new school. I'm looking at the side of it, and the sand is already starting to kind of erode away. Why? Because there's no cement, right? Somebody took the cement. And the villagers know that.
And this is, of course, what we've seen a lot of in Afghanistan, whether it's roads or whether it's other kinds of infrastructure.
Right, top-down development just really doesn't work very well, and it's an opportunity for officials to, you know, take care of themselves, not the people.
Right, corruption everywhere. Let's just again pull this all together. The stakes are incredibly high here, not just in Afghanistan, but elsewhere around the world. If we wind up repeating the bad experience of Vietnam, effectively cutting and running, if we adopt some of the successful practices that you helped operate and manage in Vietnam, perhaps combined with the kind of small footprint but high impact capacity to take the fight to the enemy as needed that Eric Prince has talked about, we may have an option for the President of the United States other than continuing to do what we've done with such futility for 18 or so years, or abandoning the place to our enemies. Would that be a fair sort of appreciation of what you're talking about, and that you would assign to it some probability of success if we did it?
If we had done this at any time, we would have defeated the Taliban in 3 years. Now, I'm not taking into consideration sanctuaries in Pakistan, another issue. But basically, 3 years is what is all you need to. And what starts to happen is the Taliban, it happened with the Viet Cong. 98% of the Viet Cong came back to the government side when they saw that their villages were very different. Lots of Taliban would come back because they all have relatives in all these villages.
They're all part of the population.
That's right. And the other thing you'd have to do is you'd have to give a vision of justice somehow, where you transcend the revenge, the blood feud heritage of the last, 30 years.
That's a pretty powerful tradition in Afghanistan and much of the world.
But I think you build on this Pashtunwali idea of sort of friendship and reciprocity. And I mean, it would take some good, close work with very bright Afghans like President Ghani, who's a very astute man in all these ways. Probably we haven't listened to him enough.
Yeah, but don't abandon them, I think, is the bottom line of this. And if we do, obviously, and you know this from very hard experience, Steve Young, that if we do abandon them, it will reinforce powerfully two things. One, again, the impression of the Sharia supremacists, as I call them, that they are going to win. And two, that there's no real, value to being allied with the United States. They will not be a reliable ally in the end. And that's not a message we want to send to the world.
If we abandon Afghanistan, the next domino which will fall will be complete Chinese domination of Southeast Asia, which when they control the sea lanes in the South China Sea, they have a potential stranglehold on the economies of Taiwan, Japan, and South Korea.
Yeah, and probably the United States to some extent as well. So high stakes, so much to learn, so appreciate what you've shared with us. Steve Young, thank you. God bless you, sir. We'll talk with you again soon. We'll talk with the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.